New Jersey Peace Action's Veterans Day soup luncheon, our 49th annual. And for those of you who have heard him before, you know that it was an extremely moving experience and that he's kind of an image. He's a person whose spirit kind of will haunted you or haunt and will continue to haunt you. But for those of you who didn't hear him, let me give you a little background on who he is, and then I will dial him up and have him speak with you. Sam Provance was a former lieutenant staff sergeant, and he was stationed in Abu Ghraib. And he was there for a number of months when he was asked to participate in what he considered to be torture techniques against a 16-year-old Iraqi boy. And if you have had a chance, on the back table we have 8.5 by 14-inch flyers of the news articles that appeared after his talk on November 11th, and they go into great detail about his particular story. And in any event, he was asked to participate in this torture. He could not do it. He refused to do it. He blew the whistle on what was going on. He was one of the people who blew the whistle on what was going on in Abu Ghraib. Obviously got in trouble with the military, got demoted, got sent out of Abu Ghraib, and then took quite a while to get himself reinstated. In the beginning of October, he was honorably discharged from the Army, and the first public appearance he had was at our soup luncheon, and he vows, pledges to continue to speak out about the impact and effect of torture, not only on those who are tortured, but on the person, the interrogator, the person who is conducting the torture. So that will be my introduction of Sam, and I will allow him to speak for himself the rest of the way as soon as I dial him up.
Sorry about that.
This is...
Okay, go ahead.
All right. I've introduced you to the perhaps 80 or 100 people who are here, and it's all yours now. You have about 15 minutes, and then we'll have about 5 minutes of questions. Can everybody welcome Sam, please? Are we still on? Okay. Sam, are you still there?
Is he on?
I know what you did, Fred, but it's...
He's not on anymore.
I don't hear anything now.
Don't stay near the mic, then. Just talk away from the mic.
Oh, it's not me. I can't hear him.
Just dial him again.
No, I'll have to redial.
Exactly what did you speak about?
Well, you were asked to speak about basically what you said at our soup luncheon about your experiences at Abu Ghraib prison.
Okay. I've been back in Germany now for about a month and a half. I'm now out of the Army. It's been quite an experience. More of a culture shock. Still getting over that. But I've been really encouraged by a lot of the support I've met since being back. one thing I've noticed is that there's a lot of things about Abu Ghraib and the like that a lot of people aren't aware of, or they are still under the perspective that has been given them by the administration. And that is such things as Abu Ghraib is just isolated to, you know, what was seen in the photographs, and that it was only the work of a few bad apples. But I can tell you for a fact that this is not the case, that it's a much bigger picture. And that, you know, when I came forward and spoke to the media, you know, I didn't do that to necessarily be any kind of a whistleblower, as some have labeled me, but I wanted to point people in the right direction to where they should be looking. And that is, you know, to the operation as a whole. You know, the belief that abuse and torture is actually something that works or is even something right to do when it is neither. And, you know, something in my experience also that I spoke about at the luncheon that a lot of people don't realize is that, you know, when we adopt such measures, that it doesn't just affect, it's not just an abuse to the abused, but it's an abuse to the abuser. Because, I mean, just imagine the psychological effect that it has on somebody when they're having to carry out these things, especially when they feel that by doing these kinds of things to people, that it is something that is right when it is wrong, and deep down they know it's wrong. I really don't know what else to say.
About the particular experience you had, if you don't mind.
Well, it was, you know, one interrogation that I agreed to be a part of. Originally, it was to be an interrogation of an Iraqi general. And when it came time for the interrogation, we were told, you know, the Iraqi general had already been broken, and that they offered us a kind of a consolation, his son. And, you know, I really didn't understand why, you know, they had his son there, but then, you know, there's always the possibility that he might have been a part of some kind of wrongdoing. And I did trust the interrogator, and that was one of the only reasons I agreed to the interrogation. Because I knew him personally. He was actually a soldier of mine during the war at one time. But, you know, come to find out later that how they had broken the general was, you know, by actually abusing the son. And that was, you know, what broke him, as they say. And I'm just, you know, having to, you know, handcuff him and put a bag on his head. You know, having to sit him down, and then they're even, you know, offering him Jolly Ranchers to soften him up. And, you know, it was just a very ludicrous situation, and he had no information that we needed. But yet they, even after that interrogation, they detained until the day I left there, and to this day I don't know what became of him. And the sad thing is about that particular situation is all those details, those particulars, were actually submitted to the General Fay investigation. And when that investigation was completed and released, that incident, you know, this boy was not even acknowledged to even be denied. They left those particulars in the statement, and to this day, that's the only place on any official record that anybody even knows he exists. And that's just a, you know, an example.
Sam, one more question for me, and that is, how do you know that it's not just a few quote-unquote bad apples?
Could you repeat that?
Yeah. What can you tell us about why you know it's not just a few bad apples at Abu Ghraib, but it is a policy? This is a policy of the administration?
Well, the MPs did not run Abu Ghraib. Abu Ghraib was a military intelligence operation. So people like the MPs were always regarded by the intelligence community as tools, as facilitators and they had clear control of them, and they would always leave instructions with the military police as far as conditions to be left with the detainees when they weren't there. And a lot of people think that Abu Ghraib was some outpost in the middle of nowhere, but it was actually the most important hub of human intelligence in Iraq, at least at the time I was there. And it was a project that they were building into something larger by the day. And the interrogators themselves were very intimately involved with their detainees. You know, it wasn't something, you know, it wasn't like they only saw them during interrogations. They would check up on them regularly. So, you know, they weren't just dumped off to the MPs and left to them until they came back to interrogate them. And, you know, I because of my duties and responsibilities in prison, it allowed me to walk about the entire operation. And, you know, and I would always ask them about what they were doing and why. You know, to get an idea of what a day in the life of an interrogator was. And it became pretty clear to me after so long just how, you know, really disorganized it was. But, you know, it's like they were learning on the fly or trying to learn. And, you know, the trouble was they wanted the information and they wanted the information now instead of using time-tested conventional methods of interrogation. And they had the idea that doing these kinds of things could detain the results they wanted. And it was just such pressure, you know, a chain reaction of pressure from on high that kept driving that. And there was even a quota system installed, you know, where people would have to submit reports regardless of what kind of information they got, and then interrogators would knowingly release false information. And then this would get put out into the field, and, you know, the wrong people, or just innocent people, for that matter, would get apprehended. And that's something else a lot of people don't realize about Abu Ghraib at that time. Anyway, it was the majority of the people never belonged there. And every single time we were attacked, usually detainees died. They were left unprotected in the open. And like I said, the majority of them were innocent. But and what was really sad to me, and it's still true today, is that most people really don't care. You know, they don't care what happens to these people, whether they're innocent or not. And I would say it's because it's convenient for them to not care. And, you know, that's something, it's really hard to understand, but it is what it is.
So, one question from the floor, and then I think we'll take some other, a couple of additional questions, Sam. And that is, how are you dealing with what you experienced, what you saw? How are you dealing with all of that today and now? Does it still haunt you? How are you dealing with it?
Well, I deal with it day to day. You know, there's a part of me that feels like I never left Abu Ghraib. You know, and that all of this is a dream, and, you know, tomorrow I'm going to wake up and I'm still going to be there. but I don't forget about the people there, and that's what it's really about. this whole thing isn't just about Abu Ghraib and just who's responsible. I mean, it's a much larger issue that's bigger than Abu Ghraib, bigger than Iraq, bigger than the army. You know, things like human rights and just, you know, keeping up the, you know, just keeping this in mind, you know, not allowing myself to become complacent or apathetic to these issues, and you know, to keep fighting the good fight, not giving in, and not allowing myself to, you know, to not kill myself. You know, doing whatever I can to think to, you know, to bring these things up and inform people. And you know, it can be hard sometimes, and so a lot of times I feel alone. And I know there are people like, you know, like yourselves that that do care and that, you know, are carrying the torch as well.
Okay, Sam, we're going to take a couple of questions from the audience, and we have a mic, so if you, but I may have to repeat the question to you, so just hold on here.
Can you hear me okay on this mic?
I can, yes. Can you hear, Sam, or do I have to repeat?
Sam, can you hear me?
No, I'll need you to repeat it.
Okay, I'll repeat.
The general who was in charge of Abu Ghraib, the brigadier general who was court-martialed, I believe, in the wake of the scandal, testified that she saw written instructions on the wall there for how the prisoners were to be mistreated over the signature of the former Secretary of Defense. Did you see anything like this on your own behalf?
I'm going to try to repeat the question. The question was, Sam, that the former general, lieutenant general who was tried there for crimes at Abu Ghraib had testified that she had seen some instructions written on the wall over the signature of former Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld about the ways in which prisoners were to be treated. And he asks whether you saw anything like that.
The only official thing of that nature I saw was this sign on the wall that had approved techniques and approaches and bended techniques that were by commanding general approval only, and which was General Sanchez. And it was like a humongous poster on the wall for all to see and read. But it's very vaguely worded and could be interpreted in all sorts of, you know, good ways, you know, such as environmental manipulation. You know, that could be one of many horrible things.
Thank you. Next question? Anyone else have a question?
First of all, I want to say, as an Army veteran myself, thank you for your service to our nation.
Let me repeat that. The questioner says, as an Army veteran himself, thank you for your service to this nation. You can all applaud.
We know that the photographs of the abuse in Abu Ghraib were taken beginning in October of 2003. We also know that General Jeffrey Miller, the commandant of Guantanamo, visited Iraq in August and September of that same year. I'm curious when your term of service was at Abu Ghraib and whether you were there when General Miller and his team came, or whether you were there when any of the documented abuse took place.
Okay, the question was that, correct me if I'm wrong, but that the photographs showed activities that had begun in October of 2003, and that just prior to that, a couple of months before that, General Jeffrey Miller, who was from Guantanamo, came to visit Abu Ghraib prison, And the question is whether or not you were there when your term of service was, and whether you were there when General Jeffrey Miller was there, or whether you were there when any of the documented abuses took place.
Well, what got me to Abu Ghraib was a mortar attack on soldiers from my battalion that were already there. And me and another soldier were sent there to replace the wounded and dead. That was in the end of September 2003. And it was shortly afterwards that a transplant of sorts from Guantanamo Bay arrived at Abu Ghraib and began implementing a new mentality as well as interrogation techniques. And there was quite a, battle between the old school and the new school at the time. And I stayed there until February of 2004. And but as far as Jeffrey Miller was concerned, I was not there for that. He was there before I was there.
Thank you. How many more questions do we have time for, Anna?
Two more
questions, right? Yeah.
My question is to follow up also on the question you had about how you're coping with after the aftermath of this experience. I was wondering what kind of support you've had from your family, your mother and father, others in your family or your community, your church. What has been your greatest support?
Okay, this is a question to follow up on how you're coping with things today. And the question was, what kind of support are you getting from your family, your community, church? Where is your strongest sense of support now since you've been back?
Well, actually, the majority of my family is against what I've done and am doing. And I don't have any real friends. Actually, my main thrust with any support I've gotten since I've been back are you guys.
Okay. One last question. Is there in the back? Yes, Maria, Stefan out there. Thank you, Sam. Just one more question.
Sure.
Hi, I'd like to know if you have been affected by any of the depleted uranium that was used in such tremendous amounts, and if you knew of any other soldiers that have been suffering from this depleted uranium also.
Okay, the question was whether you have been exposed to or affected by the depleted uranium that was used in Iraq in such large amounts, and whether or not you know others who have been affected by exposure to depleted uranium.
No, I haven't heard any stories whatsoever, actually, about depleted uranium or anyone getting sick from it. That's something that I guess you heard a lot about from Desert Storm, but at least I haven't heard anything about it. Anybody in the army while I was there.
Okay. Well, let's thank Senator.
For today, it will be Carolyn Ho,
who will be speaking about her son, Lieutenant Aaron Watada, and he's the first commissioned Army officer to face court-martial for refusing to deploy to Iraq. He's currently facing court-martial for being charged with missing movement and conducting behavior and becoming an officer. And the sentence could be up to 6 years. So it's another person speaking out and standing up for against something that's immoral and in going into Iraq. And currently his mother, Carolyn Ho, is on a speaking tour. And what we're going to be doing now is people who are supporting her we're going to be handing out a petition that you can sign to show your support for Lieutenant Watada. And we have a sign-up sheet just to join the campaign to support him. Another thing we're going to be doing is that while she's speaking, we'll be passing a hat around to help with his legal defense fund. So if you want to sign the petition, or if you want to support him in any way, or give to support his defense fund, please do so. But I want to give Carolyn a lot of time to speak. She's also going to be showing a video, or actually a DVD, throughout her program as well. So here is Carolyn Ho.
He went through basic and then decided to enter into officer training school, and subsequent to that, left for Korea. And prior to his leaving Korea, he was given the option to remain there or to come back to the States to train for the war in Iraq. And he chose to come back to train for the war in Iraq. And when he came back, this was June of 2005, he did exactly what he was trained to do. He was taught that as an officer, he had the responsibility to research the war, the history of the region he was going to enter, its effects on the population, and also on his men. And so he did just that. But as he began to read, as he began to research, things began to unfold for him, and also a change of consciousness. And he became quite conflicted because he knew what his oath was. And of course, he's a soldier, and he had gone through all of this training and been conditioned to believe that a soldier does not make any judgments on the politics of what is going on. A soldier is trained to take orders and not to question his superiors. A soldier does not have the right to speak out. And so time went on, he continued the readings, and finally he had told me later that he had an epiphany, and that was that he had not relinquished the right to choose, and that he was not a mere mercenary, that he had still the ability to judge right from wrong, and that he could stand up for what he believed in. Of course, there were consequences, and he had to be willing to take the consequences. But he said he looked around. He said they were taught that you allow your elected representatives to speak for you. But he looked around and he saw collusion between the legislative and the executive branch. Furthermore, the press was controlled by this administration. And so the American people did not really, really, really know the truth. We were fed what we needed to understand or know by this administration, and our thought patterns were controlled, basically, but by what they wanted to know. But, you know, from the little that was coming across, my son said he saw the coffins coming home. He saw the grieving of families and could not really reconcile all of that, because he was seeing that there were no weapons of mass destruction. And that despite the fact that Colin Powell went before the United Nations to stake his reputation on that, and his career, basically, that the evidence was showing that there were no WMDs, and that there were no ties to Al-Qaeda. And he then said, well, how is it that I can participate in a legal war? And how can I command my men to commit war crimes? Because inevitably, the stories were coming back. He was hearing stories from men who were at Fort Lewis, where he was stationed, and they were telling him, yes, that what was going on the ground were not just isolated incidents, they were not just exceptions, they were the rule of the day. Our soldiers, our men, our guys, you know, the boy next door, they were made to commit war crimes. And so my son said, I have the right to stand up for what is the truth, despite the consequences, and I will do that. And so on January 1 of 2006, I got the call. And I was not prepared for that. And when he told me that he was not going to deploy when the time came, I went ballistic, because I thought, this is a kid who graduated magna cum laude from college. He's very bright, very well spoken. And, you know, as a mother, I've always had dreams for my children that they would excel, that they would make an impact in society, that he would eventually land a nice job, make a good income, marry a nice girl, and I'd have grandchildren. And I could not see any kind of a future, frankly. I was just too stunned. And I said, can you not really rethink what your decision is? And can't you just finish off your tour of duty, put it behind you, and then just go on? And at that point, I knew I couldn't convince him, and so I just hung up. But it was days and days later, after I'd thought about it, that I called him. And I said, you know, I just really love you, and I don't mean to be nasty, to be, you know, unsupportive. And I'm against this war. I would do what you're doing, but I don't want you to do it. You have the rest of your life ahead of you. I have lived my life. And he said, Mom, I really understand where all of that comes from, and I know that you really love me. But he said, I felt really betrayed by the fact that you were telling me to betray my conscience. Because he said, you know, people will call me a coward, and they'll say, you can't just up and change your mind. You sign on the dotted line, and you need to go do your duty. And he said, it's not as if it's whim, where I decided I just don't feel like going all of a sudden. It's a bad idea. And he said, it's not merely because I'm afraid to die, because every human being, if they're honest, will tell you that they're afraid to die. But he said, it's more than that. I have studied this war, and I've seen what has been happening, and there is no basis for this preemptive war, and I cannot support it. So he said, at the end of the day, I have to be able to face myself. And I knew deep down that even if I didn't support him, he would do it anyway. And I told him, I said, you know, I love you, and I will do whatever is necessary to support you and to get the word out. And so this is what I've been doing. So let me fast forward to June 7th, 2006. That was the day before his 28th birthday. And he never told me. Unbeknownst to me, he got together with a group of activists and went to a press conference and announced his decision publicly. And of course, you know, I found out about it after the fact. My son basically protects me by not really telling me ahead of time what he's going to do. And I guess all of you being parents, you probably know why your children don't necessarily tell you everything. Then on June 22nd, that was the day of deployment for his particular brigade, and he had been asked prior to that by his command, we hope that you're not going to make a fuss, that you're not going to have demonstrators outside waving banners and really, you know, creating a commotion, and that we'll have to bring the MPs out. And my son said, no, I honor and respect the men for their decision. It's not mine. But I want the families to have the opportunity to say goodbye in peace. And so, no, I'm not going to go out there to disturb them. And so when the roll call came at 2:30 a.m. on the 22nd of June, he was not present to answer. After the first group left, the commanders, three of them, took my son into a small little room and began working on him, just like what Sandra Provence talked about, where they kind of soften you up and they try to convince you that If you go, you will do the best for your men. That is how you will support them, by being there on the ground with them, being the model officer. And this went on all day. They told him that he had till 10:30 a.m. on the 22nd, and they would forgive everything. They would forget the letter of resignation that he signed, stating that we had entered this war, had entered the war by facts that were worked around a policy, that it was basically deception by the administration and so on. And they said, look, we'll forget all of that and everything will go smoothly for you. But my son stuck to his guns, and little did they know that that is the person that he is. And I knew that, being a mother from the time he was very little, that once he had made a decision about something, he would not be dissuaded. And so let's fast forward to his pretrial in August of 2006. And in the military, a pretrial is for the purpose of determining whether or not there are grounds for a court-martial. And we had several witnesses, Dennis Halliday, who is the assistant to Kofi Annan. We had Dr. Francis Boyle, who was an international legal expert from the University of Illinois in Champaign. And we had Colonel Ann Wright, who had retired in protest of the president's entering into this preemptive war. And they all spoke in support of my son. The investigating officer said that this lieutenant was indeed very, very sincere. He acknowledged that. However, he said, we will go forward with the charges, and there are grounds for court-martial. The charges that they held to were, one, failure for obeying the movement order. That's a maximum of 2 years in a military prison. The second charge was contemptuous remarks against the president and administration officials. That earned him 2 years. And the last charge was behavior unbecoming an officer and a gentleman. And that earned him another 3 years. So together, we had a maximum of 8 years in a military prison. Then, I think it was about 2 weekends or a weekend after, he was invited to the Vets for Peace Convention in Seattle. And this was a closed audience. It was an audience of vets and not active military. And my son spoke his truth. And little did he know that that was to be used as further evidence to give him an extra year in a military prison. So he ended up with, let's see, he went from seven, I'm sorry, I guess I miscounted, he went from 7 to 8 years. Currently, the military has decided to throw out the second charge, and they waited till the elections were over, basically. And all of you know that, including the New York Times, which has acknowledged that this election actually was a referendum on the war. And the military, despite their saying that they're not interested in what the people have to say, they're not interested in public opinion, they are. In fact, they actually hired another person to answer the telephone calls that were coming in about my son. And so at any rate, they knocked out the second charge, contemptuous remarks against President Bush. I think they felt that they would have a hard time prosecuting that. The ACLU had submitted an amicus brief at the pretrial supporting his rights to free speech. So we are down to the two charges, and that adds up to a maximum of 6 years that we're dealing with right now. But what I'd like to do right now is to show you the Vets for Peace speech, because that basically gives you a synopsis of what his position is and the basis for why he has taken that stand. And then we'll have a question and answer.
Support. How honored and delighted I am to be in the same room with you tonight. I am deeply humbled by the company of the other wonderful speakers that came before me. You are all true American patriots. Although long since out of uniform, you continue to fight for the very same principles you once swore to uphold and defend. No one knows the devastation and suffering of war more than the veterans, which is why we should always be the first to prevent it. I wasn't entirely sure what to say tonight. I thought, as a leader in general, I should speak to motivate. Now I know that this isn't the military, and surely there are many out there who outrank me, and at one point or another, and yes, I am just an LT. Yet I feel as though we are all citizens of this great country, and what I have to say is not a matter of authority, but from one citizen to another. We have all seen this war tear apart our country over the past 3 years. It seems as though nothing we've done, from vigils to protests to letters to Congress, have had any effect in persuading the powers that be. Tonight, I would like to speak to you about an idea for a change of strategy. I'm here tonight because I took a leap of faith. My action is not the first, and it certainly will not be the last. Yet on behalf of those who follow, I require your help, your sacrifice, and that of countless other Americans. I may fail. We all may fail. But nothing we have tried has worked so far. It is time for change, and the change starts with all of us. I stand before you today not as an expert, not as one who pretends to have all the answers. I am simply an American and a servant of the American people. My humble opinions today are just that. I realize that you may not agree with everything I have to say. However, I did not choose to be a leader to be popular. I did it to serve and make better the soldiers of this country. And I swore to carry out this charge honorably under the rule of law. Today I speak with you about a radical idea. It is one born from the very concept of the American soldier, or the service member. It became instrumental in ending the Vietnam War, but it has long been since forgotten. The idea is this, that to stop an illegal and unjust war, the soldiers and service members can choose to stop fighting it. It is not an easy task for the soldier, for he or she must be aware that they are being used for ill gain. They must hold themselves responsible for individual action. They must remember duty to the Constitution and the people supersedes the ideologies of their leadership. The soldier must be willing to face ostracism by their peers, worry over the survival of their families, and of course, loss of personal freedom. They must know that resisting an authoritarian government at home is equally important to fighting a foreign aggressor on the battlefield. Finally, those wearing the uniform must know beyond any shadow of a doubt that by refusing immoral and illegal orders, they will be supported by the people not with mere words, but by action. The American soldier must rise above the socialization that tells them authority should always be obeyed without question. Rank should be respected, but never blindly followed. Awareness of the history of atrocities and destruction committed in the name of America, either through direct military intervention or by proxy war, is crucial. They must realize that this is a war not out of self-defense, but by choice, for profit and imperialistic domination. WMD, ties to Al-Qaeda, and ties to 9/11 never existed, and they never will. The soldier must know that our narrowly and questionably elected officials intentionally manipulated the evidence presented to Congress, the public, and the world to make the case for war. They must know that neither Congress nor this administration has the authority to violate the prohibition against preemptive war, an American law that still stands today. This same administration uses us for rampant violations of time-tested laws banning torture and degradation of prisoners of war. Though the American soldier wants to do right, the illegitimacy of the occupation itself, the policies of this administration, and the rules of engagement of desperate field commanders will ultimately force them to be party to war crimes. They must know some of these facts, if not all, in order to act. Mark Twain once remarked, "Each man must for himself alone decide what is right and what is wrong, which course is patriotic and which isn't. You cannot shirk this and be a man. To decide against your conviction is to be an unqualified and inexcusable traitor, both to yourself and to your country." By this, each and every American soldier, Marine, Airman, and sailor is responsible for their choices and their actions. The freedom to choose is only one that we can deny ourselves. The oath we take swears allegiance not to one man, but to a document of principles and laws designed to protect the American people. Enlisting in the military does not relinquish one's right to seek the truth, neither does it excuse one from rational thought, nor the ability to distinguish between right and wrong. "I was only following orders" is never an excuse. The New York Times showed America and the world that citizenry, as well as soldiers, have the unrelinquishable obligation to refuse complicity in the war crimes perpetrated by their government. Widespread torture and inhumane treatment of detainees is a war crime. A war of aggression born through an unofficial policy of prevention is a crime against the peace. An occupation violating the very essence of international humanitarian law and sovereignty is a crime against humanity. These crimes are funded by our tax dollars. Should citizens choose to remain silent through self-imposed ignorance or choice, it makes them equally as culpable as the soldiers in these crimes. The Constitution is no mere document. Neither is it old, outdated, or irrelevant. It is the embodiment of all that Americans hold dear: truth, justice, and equality for all. It is the formula for a government of the people and by the people. It is a government that is transparent and accountable to whom they serve, and it dictates a system of checks and balances and separation of powers to prevent the evil that is tyranny. As strong as the Constitution is, it is not foolproof. It does not fully take into account the frailty of human nature. Profit, greed, and hunger for power can corrupt individuals as much as they can corrupt institutions. The founders of the Constitution could not have imagined how money would infect our political system. Neither could they believe a standing army would be used for profit and manifest destiny. Like any common dictatorship, soldiers would be ordered to commit acts of such heinous nature as to be deemed most ungentlemanly and unbecoming that of a free country. The American soldier is not a mercenary. He or she does not simply fight wars for payment. Indeed, the state of the American soldier is worse than that of a mercenary. For a soldier for hire can walk away if they are disgusted by their employer's actions. Instead, especially when it comes to war, American soldiers become indentured servants, whether they volunteer out of patriotism or are drafted through economic desperation. Doesn't matter what the soldier believes is morally right. If this is a war of necessity, why force men and women to fight? When it comes to a war of ideology, the lines between right and wrong are blurred. How tragic it is when the term catch-22 defines the modern American military. Aside from the reality of indentured servitude, the American soldier, in theory, is much nobler. Soldier or officer, when we swear our oath, it is first and foremost to the Constitution and its protectorate, the people. If soldiers realize this war is contrary to what the Constitution extols, if they stood up and threw their weapons down, no president could ever again initiate a war of choice. When we say against all enemies, foreign and domestic.
I'm sorry, we have to cut because I think you people are leaving at 4:30, and I know you've been here for quite a while. We want to let you know that Article 6, Clause 2 of the Constitution indicates that all international treaties that we have entered into, and that includes the Nuremberg Principles, the Hague Convention, the Geneva Convention, which governs how we treat prisoners of war, the UN Charter, how we act as an occupying power. These are, according to the Constitution, Article 6, Clause 2, are the supreme law of the land. And this administration has chosen to flaunt it. So this is what my son stands for. This is his voice. And I am here to build the momentum in support of him so that he can be proven innocent. The military court is bound and determined to get its pound of flesh. And they do want prison time. But as he has said, he has done no wrong. He has committed no crime except to break the code of silence. And so I'm here to answer any questions. Yes?
I'm curious, why did your son apply for conscientious objector status? Why didn't your son apply for conscientious objector status?
Well, he does not object to all wars. He signed on to go to Afghanistan because there are ties to Al-Qaeda. Osama bin Laden used it as a training ground for his men. And so my son didn't object to that. And that is the reason. You know, he is, this one particular war he has found through his research is illegal, is immoral, and it defies our Constitution. He's a military man.
Is your son physically being detained now? And also, is there an address we could write him at?
Yes, there is. And you could check at the back tables there. He is not being detained in the sense that he's in prison. He has been able to travel within the state of Washington, and he had been going back and forth between his apartment and the fort to work in an administrative corps where they have given him very little to do. I don't think they really trust him with security information. And right now, on I think it's Tuesday or Wednesday, he's heading for Hawaii. They have given permission for him to go to Hawaii to work with his attorney on his case.
Hi, I appreciate very much your presentation. One of the thoughts that occurs to me is, since the administration is in violation clearly of the U.S. Constitution, and the president in particular, why are we not seeing articles of impeachment drawn up for the respect of President Bush?
That's an issue that this Congress does not want to deal with, actually. In fact, let me share with you that yesterday we took a trip through the halls of Congress, and some of the individuals whom we thought, you know, from our home state would support have basically said that there is a separation of power, and that the Secretary of the Army, who is the supreme commander, I guess, of Commander Dubik of Fort Lewis, comes under the executive branch, and they cannot be mixing in, you know, interfering with what is going on. And they assured me that my son will receive military justice. So that is something to really be concerned about, because the Congress basically abdicated their responsibility to the president and allowed him to make war. It's the Congress that declares war. So I think even though we have a Democratic majority, I think you will see that circulating right now in the Congress is this thing of let's just withdraw slowly and just give it to till 2008, and that we'll use our combat soldiers as trainers. Well, Nigel McCaffrey's son was a trainer, and he was actually shot at by the men he trained. So I'm very concerned, and so I'm asking you, the American people, to get on board and make your voices known, because we have explored the idea of a sign-on letter that congressional reps in different districts can sign on to. But they need to know that you, the people, support this young lieutenant who is speaking for his men, for the soldiers, to bring them home now. To take care of them. The Saint-Provences, to take care of them. And so you, as an interest group or, you know, as an organization, can get together and meet with your congressional reps. When they do town hall meetings, a lot of them will be coming home very soon. I think yesterday was the day of recess. And they will be telling you about all the wonderful things that they've done. And you can then say, well, as an organization, we have heard about this young lieutenant, and we would like you to take some action on his behalf, because we're concerned that justice will not be meted out, and that the Congress does or should have oversight. Who exactly is the military accountable to? Because we do have an Appropriations Committee in the Congress. We do have an Armed Forces Committee. We have a Veterans Committee. How can they say that they have nothing to do with what the executive branch is doing? That's ridiculous. So I think we have to hold their feet to the fire, and we have to say to them, you are accountable to us. We put you where you are, and this is what we want you to do.
Now, since I want to give the Catholic Worker people some time for questions and answers. So thank you, Calhoun, again.
Senator, was a petition in support of Lieutenant Watata. If you want to be working on his case or get a copy of the DVD, there's a separate form. Please see Eric Jurdson or myself to sign up to be more involved. Thank you.
I think I just want to just thank all our speakers. I think we had a really great program. I wanted to give the Catholic Worker group a few minutes for questions to answer for them. But also, I just wanted to point out that we were talking about impeachment before, and Cynthia McKinney, as one of her parting bills, she introduced a bill to impeach George Bush.